Iambic Audiobooks presents The Pioneer, Book 3 of the Alfred Saga by Paul Almond. Read by the author. Chapter 1, 1853. James Alfred pushed back his chair and looked up at his wife, Catherine, pouring a cup of tea by the open fire for her 80-year-old mother. Their eyes met for a moment. James saw the worry written across her features, so loved, but now so harrowed. The long, snowbound winters and toiling summers had marked both of them. "There's nothing wrong," James assured her. "Jim's just working late, that's all." But his words sounded false. Their youngest son and only heir was missing. He paused, then rose. "I'll go take a look." Catherine nodded. "Good." Strong as a birch and hair as white as the snow soon to fall, she put the teacup down by Mrs. Garrett, sitting straight as a pine in her chair. "It's going to be just fine." James reached for his wide-brimmed hat, threw on a heavy coat, and went out through the back kitchen. "When has Jim ever missed his supper?" Catherine called after him, as she began clearing the dishes from the large homemade pine table in the center of the room with its open stone fireplace. The tall, gaunt old man with his large, frayed mustache hurried up the ox track on the hill behind, scarcely looking down on the farm he had hewn out of the raw forest. His whitewashed farmhouse with its black, tarred roof, back kitchen added on, looked relatively prosperous and well kept. Next farm over, he'd given to his eldest daughter, Mariah, on her marriage to Thomas Byers, and next to that stood another house and barn that James had given to his eldest son, John, carried off in his 20s by diphtheria 10 years ago. Beyond the houses, the blue Chaleur Bay twinkled in the late sun. Over the brow and onto the flat field, James marched, his forceful stride belying his more than 7 decades on earth. A long time for someone on this harsh Gaspé Peninsula, jutting into the storm-filled St. Lawrence Gulf. With a sense of dread, he strode across this first acre, cleared some 30 years ago after his land grant of 1819. The patapata of the mill's giant water wheel echoed across the hollow. About time they used that brook for something useful. Harvey Manderson had bought the strip of land from James 4 years before, and what a blessing the grist mill had been for Catherine and the other wives in this young and growing community. 40 years ago, when James had arrived, only the Micmac knew of the brook. They had named it Shigawack. Nothing there, presumably because no spring salmon came to spawn. But James had seen quite enough fresh water for cattle and eventually to run a mill, so had stayed to settle the land. Frozen ruts squashed up by ox carts slowed his progress. Another year almost over. Soon blizzards would lock them into their houses and barns for months. Would this year now be ending in what he feared, another disastrous accident? He drove off images assailing him, an axe wound draining life's blood, or the body of Jim twisted under a fallen trunk. No, nothing could possibly have gone wrong with his youngest son. He was just working late, clearing a pasture. Jim would inherit the farm, no doubt about that. James had originally expected it to go to his first son, John. But one day, 10 years ago, John had complained of a sore throat. Not in itself worrying, he was a healthy young man in his late 20s, married, with 3 children. He'd been helping his father haul in the last of the oats. Only Catherine had interpreted the dreaded signs. For soon, with a rising fever, John had declared he was having trouble swallowing. diphtheria, the kiss of death. Perhaps with his Micmac blood from Magwess, the hidden first wife of James, he'd not developed the means to avoid white settlers' diseases. Catherine remained with him night and day. James kept hovering near, but soon it became too much. He prayed in the barn, on the cliffs, at his harrow turning up the rich earth, out loud and in silence, everywhere, over and over. But slowly, it was harder for John to swallow, and then one morning he cried out, "I can't breathe! Lord, help me! I can't breathe!" Mercifully, the end came soon. They had laid John to rest up in Paspebiac, the nearest churchyard, and marked the grave with a wooden cross, which even now was beginning to rot under the savagery of the seasons. The rest of James' offspring, save for Hannah, were all married and scattered up and down the coast. All had their own farms, so young Jim, at 19, was the only one left to inherit and farm the old homestead. And now this last-born son was late for his supper, so very unusual. Would he, too, be snatched by that familiar figure in a dark cloak, who carried such an impartial scythe to cut down no matter whom, babies, the aged, and worst of all, young men in their prime? James quickened his pace. A shout made him raise his eyes. On the next rise, four dark, misshapen creatures with hunched backs came at him, silhouetted against the brooding sky. His pace faltered. His eyes were not what they were. Carrying great sacks on their backs, the brave Byers boys loomed into his vision, following their father, Thomas. "Oh, Papa, look!" Bobby, the youngest of the rascals, came running up to his grandfather with a sack bobbing on his back. "Just look at all this here birch bark we got." He'd always been a lively child. "Hello there, Mr. Alford," James Byers said. In a land that honored older folk, even in-laws called seniors by their surnames. Farmers all, they possessed that old-world courtesy instilled by frequent Bible readings. "This bark is for young John here. Mariah said we better honor her brother's memory and keep it in shape for the little fella." Grandson John frowned. He didn't like, at 14, to be called a little fella. Dark features and shiny black hair inherited from his grandmother, Magwess, made him extremely handsome, but he was short for his age. When his father had died, his mother, Mary, after 5 years of bringing up her children alone, had married and gone to live in Gascon with her new husband, Anaye, leaving John behind with the Byers beside his own strip of land. "Good for her, but still an all kind of late for barking, no?" "Well, to tell the truth," Thomas went on, "as soon as it started to cool down this autumn, Mariah, she kept at us. I got no time for installation, I told her, but she said, 'Well, you got time tonight. No dinner till you's come back with a load of birch bark.' Ha, she's a tough one, that." Thomas was not overly handsome, with his bold, angular features and a large moustache, but one thing for sure, he was good-hearted, with a love of children. James smiled. "Well, I guess young John will be pleased when he gets old enough to live in that warm house all barked up by his uncle." "Soon, old papa," John said with his usual bravado, "I'm going to find me a wife, and I'm going to move in." James smiled, same spunk as his wonderful father, now long gone. "But you, Sir Thomas," asked, "what are you doing back here so late yourself?" "Oh, nothing," mumbled James, and then his anxiety got the better of him. "Well, you know Jim went back to clear land. You didn't hear no chopping when you were barking?" "Not a chop." James dropped his eyes, just what he dreaded. Thomas hastened to add, "Oh, I expect he's twisting out roots." I spec so, James replied. With a wave, he took off. If there had been an accident, they'd all know in very short order. And why harbor such thoughts now? You have so much to be thankful for, he reminded himself. Just count your children. 9, 8 living, and 14 grandchildren, all healthy. The good Lord above, to whom he prayed daily, had given him more than his share of happiness. So James pushed aside these ominous thoughts as he hurried back along his fence made from huge upturned roots dragged off the land by him and his boys. Lucky with his oxen, too. Smudge and Keen had worked so very hard without complaint. Keen was less keen now at 12 years old, but Smudge, whom Keen had trained, had many more good years in him. Yes, so much to be thankful for. How he loved walking through autumn woods. The leaves were feeling their last taste of an Indian summer sun before they shriveled and fell. The birch had been the first to turn, brown and russet hues, while the maple were blazing with their last flames that engulfed the whole countryside, bright vermilions and crimsons that graced the Gaspé in October. It reminded him, nowadays, of his home in the North Country, as northern counties in the old country were called. Though the autumns there were only filled with browns and sandy rust, the colour of the hull of the naval vessel on which he had served and crossed the Atlantic. The poplars here were bright with autumn colour, contrasting the glorious maple. Often, while other trees descended into their dotage, a young maple remained glistening green, a melody of shades when the wind rustled its leaves. Vivid red clumps of rowan berries brightened the fluffy green pines among the darker green of the ageless spruce. As James dipped down into a gully, he saw such lovely ferns doing their best to outcolor the trees above, ferns that in spring produced for him their succulent fiddleheads. A raucous flock of crows could be heard gathering for their southern journey, and he picked out the knock and clack of ravens signaling imminent departures. The colorful woods were emptying of their birds, though here and there he heard a warbler dropping down briefly from the north to grab a few seeds before migrating south. All around, foxes and skunks were fattening themselves for their long hibernations, and, in spite of frosty nights, a few wildflowers cast up their yellow and white faces in search of the last rays of the sun as it spiraled lower. The whole countryside sang in a symphony of color before it shaded into those ominous grays and blacks of bare trunks and bark, relieved only by perching tufts of early snow. Then these stark sentinels of winter, soon shorn of leaves, would speak loudly of the death of another season. So many he'd seen coming and going. The back section of the farm was divided by a sloping gully. He reached the shallow bridge built of stones picked from the field one by one and hurried over it. Beyond Chigawack Brook, he saw the partly cleared pasture Jim had been working on and paused. Did he really want to cross the log bridge and find an awful truth? He allowed the familiar sound of his brook to have its calming effect. How he had enjoyed that gentle gurgling long ago while at his cabin down at its mouth, so comforting when loneliness struck, as it often used to. He had made his way here from Port Daniel Estuary, where the Bellerophon, one of the finer ships of the line in His Majesty's Navy, had pulled in for shelter during a savage spring storm. Seizing what was undoubtedly his last chance to escape the Navy and try his hand at being a settler, James had jumped off and swam ashore, so becoming a deserter. Such tortured years on the run keeping one jump ahead of the Marines, who meted out the inevitable punishment for deserters, death by 1,000 lashes. Once they had very nearly caught him. He had gone looking for work in New Carlisle, and, as was the custom, had been invited by the Garretts to stay the night. As soon as they had guessed his true identity, the feckless Garrett sons had left to inform the justice of the peace of his whereabouts. But dear Catherine, she had saved him. Such a quick thinker, even then. As he remembered, a smile tweaked his lips. How great had been the future that lay ahead of them, though he had not known it then. He had won her and brought her here to his cabin by the brook, then built his house and cleared his farm, and they'd had 30 good years together, thank the Lord. Now this would all pass to his youngest son, Jim. Oh, yes, indeed. Thus cheered, he stepped resolutely forward, crossed the brook onto a rolling, half-cleared pasture land, and stopped, afraid. Summoning up strength, he called loudly, "Jim! Jim!" "Over here," came the rejoinder. His son was safe. James strode forward. How much Jim now resembled himself at that age. Wiry and thin, his childhood blonde hair inherited from Catherine, now dark brown, though last summer's sun highlighted it with bronze, his brown eyes frank, striking, set in an unconventionally handsome face, bold rather, even audacious. Just as James himself must have appeared on the Bellerophon before he deserted. But now he began to remonstrate with Jim for his lack of concern, how worried his mother had been at his missing supper. Then he heard the awful reason. "See, Papa, I wanted to get all this here cleared fast, 'cause I've come to decide something." He looked down, not wanting to meet his father's direct gaze. "You see, I've been thinking I've a mind to take off." James stared at him. What was he saying? "You see, Papa, you growed up in England. You've sailed the high seas. God knows what else you did when you was my age. But you sure didn't sit in one place small as this one here, and then all your life having nothing to remember. I think I'd die if I never went anywheres." James opened his mouth to speak, but words failed him. "Maybe it's your blood, Papa, beating in me heart." Jim made a half-hearted attempt to smile. "But you showed me the way. I want to go. I've got to go. I am going. Right after I get our 10 cord of firewood felled for the winter, I'm making tracks for the big city. For Montreal." James stood stock still. Jim, leaving? Leaving all of them? And the farm that one day would have been his own? And James saw there was not one thing he could do about it